Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world. With host Jason Brooks.
Thank you for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. The pandemic has taken center stage, but a major mystery has erupted out of the COVID-19 shadows with questions over the health of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, on reports he may have had heart surgery, and on his absence from key events. Some are questioning whether Kim is even alive. Joining The Crisis Next Door to help sort out this mystery and what it means going forward if Kim is indeed unable to continue ruling is Dr. Jung Pak, Senior Fellow and SK Korea Foundation Chair in Korea Studies at Brookings Institution. Dr. Pak also worked for the CIA, and she's the author of a new book called Becoming Kim Jong-un, recently published by Ballantine. Dr. Pak, thank you for joining The Crisis Next Door.
Thanks so much for having me, Jason.
Well, first off, good timing with your new book, Becoming Kim Jong-un. It's almost as if you knew what would be happening. So what do you think? Is Kim Jong-un still alive?
So no one will know exactly where he is or how he's doing or his exact health status. But there have been various reports that he's gravely ill, to he's recovering, or he's at his beachfront villa, or he's somewhere else. I mean, so there's a lot of speculation about his exact status and his health. And that raises a lot of questions that affect our national security as well as regional stability in East Asia.
Now, one of the events that Kim missed was the annual ceremony marking the birth of his grandfather, Kim Il-sung. How big of a deal is that?
Yeah, so April 15th, his absence was very much noticed, especially because Kim Jong-un is everywhere and he seems to be omnipresent. But April 15th is like, in North Korea, it's like Christmas and 4th of July and New Year's Eve and all the birthdays all combine into one. And so for him to miss something like that, especially given the fact that his legitimacy rests on the legacy of his grandfather, that raised some eyebrows. And that raised a little bit of a flag for me. But that event and that absence in and of itself, it wasn't necessarily or isn't necessarily anything to be worried about, given the fact that that Kim has been trying to kind of step out of his grandfather's and his father's shadows over the past couple of years. But it's the other things. It's the volume of conflicting reporting and his absence that keeps the speculation swirling. And it seems to me that something is amiss. We just don't know what that is. And again, so I think this raises a lot of questions about what's going on in North Korea, about internal stability, and what we should do about it.
When Kim took control in 2011 after the death of his father, he initially seemed to present a different image than his father and grandfather, a bit more worldly, willing to smile for the cameras. But in the end, is he any different from his predecessors in his rule of North Korea?
Right. So Kim Jong-un, when he came to power after his father died in 2011, he seemed to draw more from his grandfather's legacy. His grandfather was a revolutionary or was a guerrilla fighter, fought against the Japanese. He initiated the Korean War in 1950, and he built a country from scratch with Soviet help, obviously. And his grandfather was much more gregarious, which was tall, very charismatic. The second Kim Jong-il wasn't very charismatic. He was much shorter. He was more introverted. And Kim Jong-un, Kim 3.0, as I like to say, has been much more like his grandfather. He's much more active. He speaks in public, which his father never did. He's hugging children. He's pulling weeds. He's at the water park waving to people. And he's photographed with women aviators. So this is somebody that who wants to be very out in the open, wants to be that charismatic leader, and has adopted the mantle of his grandfather.
If Kim can no longer rule, or his days of ruling are growing short, succession becomes the key issue. Now, a lot of speculation has centered on Kim Jong-un's younger sister, Kim Yo-jong. How do you view potential succession, and who's most likely to come out on top?
You know, one of the things that we don't want to do is underestimate North Korea, and that goes for the leaders as well. And many, some analysts have suggested that because North Korea is such a patriarchal society, that a woman leader would never hold muster. But I would argue that she would be near the top of my list in terms of a possible successor, or at least somebody to keep the country together. She has been, she has the pure bloodline. The North Koreans are very particular about bloodlines and the purity of this one. And this is something that regime propaganda has pushed for decades. She has the bloodline. She has the proximity to her brother, which her brother has cultivated. He's given her over the years a bigger profile, diversifying her portfolio. She has leadership positions. And of course, she was seen at the Winter Olympics in South Korea back in early 2018. She was in Singapore with President Trump and her brother, and she was in Hanoi again for that second summit. So her profile has been building, and I think this was a calculated move by Kim Jong-un to do so. She's obviously a trusted confidant. She's been acting as his de facto chief of staff. So she would be near the top of my list. And if anything happened, I could see her at least, the regime or whoever takes over, if it's a collective leadership or otherwise, that they would need a Kim family at the head.
What do we know about Kim Yo-jong's personality? What is she like as a person?
Well, we don't know what she's like as a person, but the way the regime portrays her, at least in its media, as a very efficient, productive person, right? She's not decked out in bling. She's not, wearing lots of colors. She's not a very flashy person. And she's always, lurking in the shadows or hovering over her brother to make sure that everything's going well. So the image is that of a productive, efficient, reliable, dependable person. I think that's something that's what the regime wants to say about her or tell about her. It was said that it's reported that Kim Jong-il, her father, and Kim Jong-un's father, had once said back in 2001, told the Russian ambassador to North Korea that his daughter, Kim Yo-jong, was the savviest and the smartest one of the bunch. In the past 6 years where she's actually had known leadership positions in the regime, she's almost certainly developed and honed those political and savvy skills.
Even though North Korea has been a patriarchal society for decades, is there a chance for a military coup?
There's always a chance for a military coup, but I think that the chances are low. The reason I think it's a low likelihood of a military coup is that for decades, the Kim family has had overlapping security apparatuses. And that's not just at the top, it goes throughout society where even at the neighborhood at the grassroots level, it would be blasphemous to talk ill of anybody, of the Kim family. And so it's this culture of fear and repression that makes everybody an informant, prevents the kind of horizontal connections that would be required for any kind of protest or a military coup to occur. And so we're not going to be facing an Arab Spring. People are not connected in that way. And also they're too fearful about what might happen next. And given some of the ambiguity, the high level of ambiguity about who's where and who's doing what, it would be pretty treacherous and very dangerous and risky for anybody to stick their head up and try to start something.
We've seen two successions in the Kim family. Would this potential succession be more destabilizing than those prior successions for the Korean Peninsula?
Yeah, Kim Jong-un came to, there was a rapid succession process before Kim Jong-un came to power, which was really spurred on by the father's stroke in 2008. And that's when Kim Jong-il, the second Kim leader, he jump-started and really amplified the succession process, given the fact that he was, he had the stroke in 2008. But this would be much more compressed, much more sudden, given the fact that Kim has only been in power for 8 years. Kim Jong-un has been in power for 8 years. He's still very young. His children are very young, and the sister is very young. But as I've said before, it would be a mistake to underestimate this family.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about the mystery surrounding Kim Jong-un with Dr. Jung Pak, Senior Fellow and SK Korea Foundation Chair in Korea Studies at Brookings Institution, and also the author of a new book called Becoming Kim Jong-un. Dr. Pak, you wrote in Politico that President Trump's approach has become fragile regarding North Korea because of his desire to negotiate mano a mano with Kim rather than relying on the diplomatic corps. Just how damaging is that strategy if Kim is no longer in charge?
President Trump, tried something new, and I think that was worthwhile to do. And that is to establish a leader-to-leader ties, establish a rapport that has never been done before, and to try to move things forward. But the problem was really in the implementation. President Trump admitted that he did not need to prepare for his meetings with Kim. He was more certain about his ability and his charisma to try to extract these concessions from Kim, even though the intelligence or the information and the analysis about Kim would say different. It was worth trying to see what Kim would bite on. The issue, though, is that President Trump has, given the fact that all this leader-to-leader ties were established, that gave very little space or incentive for Kim Jong-un to actually move forward with working level conversations. So from my perspective, the working level discussions were cut off at the knees before even they started. Another issue is that the president, to preserve this good relationship, has looked the other way on ballistic missile tests that are dangerous for our allies in the region. He has dismissed them as very standard. He has said that every country does these missile tests, even though the missile tests that the North Koreans were doing were in contravention of UN Security Council sanctions. So he's turned a blind eye to the missile tests, the weapons tests, the artillery drills. He's turned a blind eye to North Korea's human rights violations. And he's turned a blind eye to building and maintaining our relationships with our allies in the region, specifically South Korea and Japan. And their cooperation and close coordination with them is required for is required for success in having any approach to North Korea.
You also wrote about Trump's gutting of the national security bureaucracy. Is the U.S. lacking intelligence on North Korea, and how does that affect decision making?
We wouldn't necessarily have insight into the closest, a leader's health. And that's not just true of North Korea, which has really robust counterintelligence practices, but it's also true of other, world leaders in general. But regardless of that, the intel community is a group of civil servants, a sprawling 17 entity or organization, the intelligence community is, and that requires a strategic vision, good management, and solid management. These are the people at the front lines of any collection of information, analysis, diplomatic maneuvers, as well as planning for military or humanitarian aid. It's not a secret that the president has not looked very kindly on the intelligence community. I think that, really has a deleterious effect on how prepared we can be for a post-Kim scenario or even now.
Trump isn't exactly chummy with China right now, having waged a costly trade war and now dealing with a pandemic. How delicate of a situation is North Korean succession for U.S.-Chinese relations?
The Chinese government typically does not like to discuss or does not want to discuss contingency plans or North Korean collapse scenarios or anything to that extent. The Chinese government is even less likely to be participating in those kinds of conversations now, given all of the problems in the relationship that you've articulated. And the Chinese government has also loosened some of the implementations of the sanctions that the international community and the U.S. has taken so much effort to build. China's cooperation is absolutely critical. North Korea, China is North Korea's biggest political and economic partner. North Korea relies on China for over 90% of its total trade. China obviously and clearly needs to have a lot of input in this, and its cooperation is absolutely critical to any approach to North Korea.
There have long been worries about North Korean government collapse, creating a flood of refugees into China. How concerned should Beijing be about that potential scenario?
Beijing is absolutely worried about something like that, and its priority on the Korean Peninsula is not is stability first, because they don't want the destabilizing effects of massive refugee flows or a North Korean collapse. And that's one of the problems of our relationship with Beijing, and why the North Korea issue has persisted to this day, is that the U.S. policy of denuclearization, sooner rather than later, is at odds with China's prioritization of stability. The Chinese government will be more willing to try to keep propping up the North Korean government versus trying to get denuclearization. So I think that's a tension that's existed in the past 10, 15, 20 years, and it's likely to persist in the coming years.
Given a potential succession, does that raise fears that North Korea's potential nuclear and biological and chemical weapons stockpiles could be sold to non-state actors?
Yeah, that's always in the worst case scenario in which there's internal collapse or there are factions fighting with each other. That in that event, that there is a greater incentive for loose nukes, or that these groups will try to seize the nuclear weapons, either to establish their legitimacy by holding the crown jewels of the regime, or to sell the weapons to non-state actors or bad actors to try to generate revenue for the regime. So that is a low likely, low probability, high impact scenario that would be devastating for not just regional stability, but for global security.
Tough to get any news out of North Korea. But Dr. Pak, do we have any idea how the COVID-19 outbreak is affecting life in North Korea?
The North Korean regime's statements, public statements on COVID, is that they have zero infections. They have taken early on since January, they've locked down the borders, they've locked down the trade, They have quarantined at least 10,000 people by their accounts. So everything has been in lockdown. There's been a lot of, they've used the propaganda machinery to instruct people on hygienic practices. The regime has been showing officials and cleaning crews disinfecting in a very public way. They've shut down the public facilities, the water park, the amusement park. They've shut down tourism. So they've basically been locked down since late January. So that's been, as we've seen in other places of the world, that's been pretty effective in stemming an exponential rise in infections. But given the extensive border, it's a 900 mile border with China. And as we know, China has had the biggest outbreaks of COVID, that it would be nearly impossible for North Korea to have zero cases. And so we'll see reports trickling out from contacts in North Korea where, 100 North Korean soldiers at such and such border with China died as a result of symptoms that looked like coronavirus, or 200 soldiers there. Or North Korean defectors talking to their family members inside, and they would say, oh, it's really bad in X, Y, and Z province. So you'll see some of those things coming out, but with North Korea, because of its dilapidated medical infrastructure probably the lack of testing, it's possible that these people are dying with coronavirus, but we just don't know because there hasn't been testing. People dying in their homes or dying in the fields that are written off as the flu or malaria or something else that's not corona. So it's really hard to say, but it would be a near impossibility for North Korea to not have any cases of corona.
So many unknowns in North Korea, including the health status of Kim Jong-un. Dr. Pak, thank you for joining the Crisis Next Door.
Thank you so much, Jason. Really appreciate the opportunity.
We've been joined by Dr. Jung Pak, Senior Fellow and SK Korea Foundation Chair in Korea Studies at Brookings Institution. Dr. Pak also worked for the CIA, and she's the author of a new book called Becoming Kim Jong-un, recently published by Ballantine. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
Vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.